Support for the Soundwriters Show is provided in part by Adventure Motorsports, Snohomish County's largest selection of Yamaha and Suzuki motorcycles, ATVs, quads, and UTVs are available in Monroe at Adventure Motorsports. Celebrating a decade of top-rated sales, service, parts, and accessory support, hit the road and visit Adventure Motorsports today.
And now live from the Crow's Nest Studio in beautiful downtown Broadview, Washington, join us for the latest episode of the Soundwriters Show. A candid hour featuring the people, places, and things that make up the fabric of one of the top motorcycle riding destinations in the world. And now, here are your hosts, Tom Maron, Derek Roberts, and whoever else happens to drop by today.
Welcome, riders, to the April 2016 edition of the Soundwriters Show. Show number 1604. I don't know how we come up with that math. It's tricky.
It's there, but it's the April show, and no fooling, right?
No fooling.
That's it.
There'll be no fooling during this show.
That's right. Well, all kinds of great stuff, though, happening, of course, as we're starting to roll into the warmer months here. And, you know, I think we should dive right into it because we had a great March issue. We've got some great stuff coming in April, but a lot of articles jumping off the homepage, and I think we should talk about a few.
Yeah, I think what's happening out there is, for those of you who don't ride all year, you may be realizing it's now riding
it's
season.
It's now the time, definitely. We're seeing some sunshine, some warmer weather.
So we did our article on five bucket list roads for Oregon that were paved.
That's right.
It went nuts.
It went nuts. I mean, we had thousands.
15,000 views on that.
I mean, that's incredible. And that was just alone off of the Facebook page. And then we had, you know, many more thousands off the homepage. I mean, it got to a lot of people in the region, which is great.
So I immediately went and crafted up a five Oregon dual sport rides.
That's right, yeah.
And again, that one went pretty nutty. So I know we're throwing out a lot of ideas for you guys and gals to go ride.
Get out and ride. Paved
or dual sport. And in fact, I thought, why not just rerun an archive piece that's still timely? And that's all about Idaho's scenic byways.
So, I mean, literally we're talking about the entire Pacific Northwest here. And we'll see maybe rolling into this month here. We'll probably maybe keep some of those up on the homepage. But make sure you search for them in the archive if you hadn't had a chance to read them.
Yeah, definitely. You can click on the top of the navigation bar on Soundwriter. Just click on More and then hit the first link that says Search Soundwriter. And you can search the rides. Or you can go down further and hit the editorial archive link.
That's
right. And then you can just pull down the menu for rides.
And that's, we've seen a lot of new readers and not a lot of new listeners over the last year. So I know that you don't really like to talk about this too much, Tom. But, of course, you have a lot of great books where a lot of these rides were inspired from. And so if you're new to the show, new to Soundwriter, make sure you get into the store, check out some of those books. You've got all kinds of rides in Oregon, Washington, dual sport, and paved. So, you know, check out the rides.
Yeah,
and,
in fact, we have a whole series of self-led tours.
That's it, yeah.
So,
and, of course, such a beautiful region to be in. But let's talk about an article that was in last month's issue here, Target Zero. Right, now that's a guy, I've been spacing on his name.
Written
here.
By Mike Turcotte, a former Washington State Patrol officer,
right,
who served on a committee to try to get down the number of deaths.
Yes. You know, not just the number of deaths, but also, well, that's the genesis of the name Target Zero, of course, but I think just safety in general as far as motorcycling is concerned, in
exactly.
Washington specifically, right?
In Washington State.
Right.
But, you know, every state sort of has its own program like that, or at least they're thinking about it all the
right.
time. So, you know, I thought Mike laid it out real well. And with a name like Target Zero, there could be no other goal than zero fatalities, which upsets some people because they think that really what the State Patrol wants to do is shut down motorcycling altogether.
Right, which is just foolish. This is nonsense.
Well, I'm not sure which order this is going to happen in. They're either going to do that first and then come and get our guns.
Right.
Or they're going to come and get our guns and then shut down motorcycling altogether.
That's right. I think sooner or later the plan is for everybody just to stay at home, never leave, and just keep paying taxes, right?
Yeah, well, get like an Xbox One.
There you go, yeah.
And have some fun.
We specialize in reality here at Soundwriter. We like to actually get out and do things, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk, though, a little bit more about the article. So a few details here. So first of all, since 2005 in the state of Washington, motorcycle fatalities have fluctuated between 67 and 84, right? So pretty consistent within that range.
Yep.
So that's, you know, again, target zero, trying to get that number reduced to zero. And a couple of the recommendations that the organization has made include conduct a top-to-bottom assessment of Washington's motorcycle training program, which that seems like something that you should do every couple of years anyway, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you should always take into account updated data and review the program, see what's working, see what isn't, and make
changes. I think what's a little bit tricky in that is that the state is contracted through Motorcycle Safety Foundation for their program.
Sure.
And so they don't want to upset the apple cart the way that Oregon did and go and do their own program, which I think they probably should do. Oregon did it. I think it's working well for them. It's much more tailored toward what the rider's going to be seeing in Oregon. And remember, when we talk about these fatality counts, a good percentage of them, maybe 20, 30, I don't have the number in front of me,
right,
are people from out of state.
Sure.
So we can't do anything to train them or make sure that they got the best training possible.
But fortunately, we have seen throughout the greater West Coast region, but specifically here in the Northwest and California, a lot of the states evaluating their programs and making changes, right?
Yeah.
So hopefully some of the more local riders regionally will start to bring that number down a little bit.
So in Oregon now, if you want to ride a motorcycle, you have to get the training that the state provides. And that was new about 4 or 5 years ago, and they've been grandfathering that in over the last few years. In Washington State, you don't have to take any training. All you have to do is pass the test.
Right.
Now, what they've done recently on that is if you go to take the test, you'll be going to one of the contractor's locations to take the test.
Okay.
If you don't pass the test, obviously that contractor is going to recommend that you get yourself into a motorcycle training class.
Makes sense, yeah.
So at least we're getting there, but we haven't made training mandatory yet.
Which is something that, I mean, I think a lot of that too, mandatory training, and we've had some back and forth over the past, you know, episodes where we talk about things like helmet laws, mandatory training, and that kind of stuff. I usually come down on the side of where I'd like to see more emphasis from the private side, including manufacturers and these training schools, and even organizations like ourselves, right, to really encourage riders to go and seek that out on their own.
So but the way the system's set up, you're getting exactly that with the training schools.
Right.
By them conducting the testing for the state.
That's right. So this training schools will be conducting the testing, but I'm talking about maybe sort of the ethic more at large here is to see, like, especially the manufacturers, you know, to really come out and say you should be taking these steps on your own to become a better rider.
Well, didn't you read your owner's manual?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they put it in there. They encourage you in the owner's manual.
My 96 Suzuki didn't come with an owner's manual.
Oh, you just get it online.
That's right. No, it's out there. It definitely is. But a couple other recommendations that came from the Target Zero guys, including address the disparities in the use of training facilities statewide, redistribute resources to reduce waiting times for training. The goal should be less than a 30-day wait to get into a class. Now, this was interesting to me because obviously in the greater Seattle metro area here, we have the greatest concentration of classes. I didn't realize that this was an issue. Is this something that you've heard about?
It gets that way sometimes in the summer. Okay. Not every year. There have been years, like when the economy was slower, so less motorcycles were being sold, that the classes, you were able to get in pretty quick.
Right.
And then when the economy is really good in the summertime, you might be waiting 45 or 60 days to get into a class.
Which is not ideal if somebody thinks that they can sign up in June, and the next thing you know, it's August before you can get in, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then that's one of those situations, too, where maybe you start going to Uncle Harry for tips, and you start to develop those bad habits.
Oh, get the Billy Bob back 40 lesson? Yeah.
And so a couple other notes on here. Allow riders to take basic rider training on their own bikes, which that kind of makes sense, don't you think?
Maybe, but, you know, there's enough guys, and I don't see this so much with women, but I'm sure it has happened. But there's plenty of guys who think their first bike needs to be BMW K1200 LT.
Sure. I always recommend a Ninja 1000.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't think I want that guy taking the training on the course with basically a weapon.
That's true. Although, do you think that there could be perhaps be some value in that, and that somebody rolls out there in a big bike like that and realizes that comparatively he can't handle it?
I think the value is using the training bikes, because if you dump that 1,000cc motorcycle at the class, You know, that was not necessary.
That's true.
If the state bike is there, do it on the state bike.
Right.
And then maybe it will also wind down someone to understand, hey, maybe that big bike you got, maybe you need to put that in the garage for a few months and
sure.
get something in between what we had at the class and what you've got right now. And, you know, the beauty of that is you buy it today for $2,000, you sell it 6 months from now for $2,000.
For $2,000, that's right. There's always new riders. And, of course, you know, we always kind of say, I would say anyway, as a general rule of thumb, probably 250 to 350 cc, at least for those first couple of months, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Some other points on here is to include motorcycle awareness in the driver's education curriculum and the state driver's guide.
I think that's been implemented now.
Yeah.
So
that's one of those things, though. I mean, that's... It's still your best defense, right, is to keep your head on a swivel when you're on a motorcycle. You can't rely on other motorists.
Don't plan. Yeah, don't plan that the car that's pulling out in front of you right now got that message.
Right, and not that everybody would or anybody would think that, but still always good to note. Develop a public education campaign directed at riders under 25, riders over 40, and motorists. The campaign should target the rider behaviors most likely contribute to motorcycle crashes, lane errors, speed, inattention, and impaired riding.
And this goes hand in hand with the age demographics of who's crashing the
sure.
most.
And I think it's something like, is it 2/3 of motorcycle accidents in the state of Washington are single vehicle?
Yeah.
So it's like overrunning your turn.
And quite a few of them, I think it's like 30% of the deaths.
Right.
Goes right in line with the 30% of riders who don't even have an endorsement.
Yeah. Which is, there's obviously some correlation there, I think. And then the last note on here that they make as far as recommendations is encourage law enforcement to focus its efforts on the moving violations noted above, which was, you know, errors, speed, inattention, and impaired riding, as well as in non-endorsed riders and inattentive drivers. So a lot of there's some emphasis here on education.
Let's go to that.
Yeah.
So you're a state patrol officer,
right?
Do you know what the requirement is of you if somebody is riding a motorcycle without an endorsement?
I wouldn't have any idea. Yeah.
The requirement is for you to call a tow truck and have a truck ticket away.
Okay. So,
but they don't do that every time.
Right.
And I've always said if they don't follow that requirement, then basically they put the state at a liability by letting that rider ride off on a bike
right.
who hasn't proved that they can actually ride a motorcycle and already got pulled over for something.
That's
so.
A good point. Yeah. Definitely. Well, and again, you know, I don't think that this is something that the greater motorcycling public at large should definitely be aware of. But I think for our riders, we tend to have pretty, I don't know, sophisticated.
I'd say that most of our listeners would agree with a lot of what we're saying right here.
I think so.
And I think a lot of them would agree with what we, you know, we put Mike's article up. He wrote his one side.
Yeah.
Somebody in a Facebook group said,
right.
Oh, shame on you, Soundwriter, for running that type of material.
Sure.
And I say to anybody who wants to say that, you go ahead and write a rebuttal. And if it looks good, we'll run it. I'm all for having this conversation.
Discussion, absolutely. I think that's how we move the needle forward. And again, this was written by Mike Turcotte. I know we highlighted some of the details in the article, but really we only touched on probably about half of the points here. So make sure you get to soundwriter.com and check it out. And also note that Mike was at the Rally in the Gorge with us last year.
He was,
right?
Yeah.
And is, I don't know if...
I think he'll be back again this year. I don't know
good.
If he'll be presenting, but he'll be helping out on the Maryhill Clinic. And
oh, fantastic.
Sort of thing, so.
Yeah. Well, we'd definitely like to see that. So get there and check out that article. Now, I know we want to wrap up this first segment pretty quick, but I want to get back to a little bit on some of the tiered riding systems we've talked about in the past as far as endorsements. What would be some suggestions? Do you think the state should adopt a...
So, the history on that, because you weren't here when it was in effect, we did have a three-tier system.
Okay.
And that went away around 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you could get a certain endorsement for up to X amount of CCs and then blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But it kind of went away. I'm not sure, you know. I threw out the idea, why don't we have a metric of how old you are, how many miles you ride a year, how big is your motorcycle, and then we'll figure that all out and figure out which tier you fit into.
Right.
That's never going to happen.
That's, you know, that you're probably right. That'll never happen.
And you have to factor horsepower, too, because I think, you know, Jessica had a good point. She said, you know, how can you, if you do a tiered system at 1,000 cc's, My R100 has 40 horsepower.
It's true.
And the R1000S that's on the market now, or S1000,
right,
has 140 or 160 horsepower.
Or even if you take something like a Ninja 300 versus a KLR 650, you might take that in a straight line, right, any day. But I think maybe that might be an interesting something for you and I to discuss and maybe write an article about for recommendations for new riders based on some of those criteria.
Then they'll start shaming us again. But I'd do it.
We have to be the torchbearer, though, right? Because we want to have...
It gets people talking.
Yeah, and we want to have people, of course, ride and ride safely for many, many years to come.
And last thing I want to mention about the recent issue, you did a nice piece on the Moto Guzzi V7.
That's right, the V7 Stone.
So, nice piece, and we just did a little post on that. And I also want to thank Rolf E. Mugabe for doing a nice piece on the Aprilia Tuono 1000, or 1100R.
That's right.
That's what it is.
And a big thanks to Dave at Moto International, who'll be joining us a little bit later, for lending us those bikes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll do the calendar.
Stick around.
Hello, this is Harold Olaf Cecil from Giant Loop, and you're listening to The Sound Rider Show.
Hey, I'm Gordon from West Seattle, and one of my favorite recent rides was the Reuben Run down in Oregon.
Back in studio on the Sound Rider Show on this April edition. And of course, as we talked about in the opening here, sun's starting to come out for a lot of riders. This is when they're going to be rolling the bike out. And you know what? April's got a lot of great things on the calendar, so let's get right into it.
So April 2nd and 3rd is the Desert 100. That would be the day following April Fool's Day. So fortunately, there's no events going on April Fool's Day.
That's right. None that we're aware of, anyway.
And so that's out there in Odessa, Washington. And I know we've been up on Wild Horse at the Wild Horse Wind Farm and watched the dust explode out there.
Nice.
it gets rather dusty.
Well, yeah, and there's some poker runs, it sounds like, as well as a dual sport route. And it looks like always a good time out there, you know. And that's April 2nd coming up here pretty quick.
And then on April 3rd, Too Fast has a track day at the Ridge Motorsports Park.
Right.
And the reason that I mention that is that we have a lot of track days coming up. So anybody who feels like they want to do a track day this year, now is time to go online and sign up for one.
Yeah, start planning, get your bike ready.
And we'll actually have an interview a little bit later in the show with our friends from MotoFit Group.
Great.
And they'll be talking about the track days.
Look forward to that, definitely.
On the 6th, we've got Old Bike Night in Georgetown, the monthly gathering of old motorcycle enthusiasts.
That's right. And again, for those outside of the Seattle area, that's just one of the neighborhoods, the greater downtown Seattle here.
And then on the 8th, OMRA is going to have a new racer school. So if you think you want to do some racing and you want to get into the amateur class, this is where you go to get all the briefing on what's happening.
That's right, and only $199, and that includes your race license, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nice.
That's right.
Can you get some tires with that too, or I guess not?
Yeah. Go and see Don at All Moto Tires. He'll get you set up for a few $100 more.
All right, on the 9th, second Saturday is at WAM. We've been talking about this, but the weather's getting nicer now. I want to remind people to go check out the Western Airplane and Automobile Museum in Hood River, which also has a nice collection of motorcycles.
That's right. You know, as an aviator and a motorcycle rider, this is definitely on my bucket list for a late spring or early summer. I really want to take a ride down there. And Hood River, too. I mean, come on, man. That's about as good as it gets.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it's blossom time down there.
Oh, yeah.
So everything's in bloom.
Right.
All the fruit trees are in bloom. It's just beautiful. It's like this carpet of white and pink everywhere.
Such a beautiful area.
And then on the 16th of April is the annual CMA Tail of the Snake event. They've moved it to Colfax, Washington this year. I don't have a lot of information because the link that goes to the Facebook page is right. A closed group. So if you want to know more about it, you're going to have to message them off of Facebook or something.
That's right. Or if you go to the calendar section on SoundRider, there is an email for whoever's
writing
that.
Oh, that's right. So. Okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Palouse in the spring, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do that. You're pretty fortunate to live in the Northwest here, huh?
And then we'll be back with round number 61 of the Backfire Moto Night down in, what's the name of that part of town?
Yeah, that's Ballard.
Oh, Ballard.
That's
yeah.
it. Always a good time. And, you know, honestly, that's one of those things, if you're thinking about maybe coming up to Seattle as a motorcycle rider, you know, if you can get a long weekend and come up here, that's always on a Wednesday, right? That's kind of worth checking out. It's a pretty neat event.
All right. Let's see. And then the Washington Vintage Motorcycle Group is having their annual swap meet up in Mount Vernon on April 23rd. That's always a good time, always some good stuff. But you got to get there early because the stuff goes fast.
So right.
If you're into vintage bikes and you're looking for stuff, you want to hit that.
And harder to get those parts.
And you said that you're both an aviator and a motorcyclist. I don't know if you've ever been to this event before. It's called the Glider Cycle World Tour.
Really?
And these guys have all like BMW F650s and F800s.
Interesting.
And this starts at the top of Tiger Mountain, and it's like a race down, except that what they actually do is launch the bikes off of Tiger Mountain, and then they fly down with a glider attached to the bike.
So, and this is in Tiger Mountain. This is in Oregon.
No, Tiger Mountain in Issaquah.
In Issaquah, okay. Yeah. So just outside of the Seattle area
yeah,
here.
Yeah, and they land in that field down there that's on the Issaquah-Hobart Road.
Sure. Now, have you been to this before?
Yeah, a couple times. And we actually have an article on SoundRider. If you search Glider Cycle,
sure.
You can read the article and find out more about it. I think when I wrote the article, they didn't even have the F800s out yet, but they did have the F650s.
So this has been an annual thing for some years.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder how they get this set up here, because this is something, I'd be interested in.
Yeah, I think it's something where you know, that's like public land up there, and sure. You get some sort of permitting to be able to launch the bikes off. But never had an accident or anything. You know, it's just nice when you land, you just kind of grab the throttle and ride away. And
right.
You detach the glider. And
well, that definitely sounds like something home. To check out. So we need to let our listeners know, when is this going down?
It's
going to
be on the 31st of April, and that's a Thursday. And so they know that's a work day for people, and they don't want to have a lot of traffic stopping along the road, so they won't actually start the races until like 7 p.m.
Okay, so in the evenings they do it then.
Yeah, and it goes for like an hour.
Well, I tell you what, that's the 31st of April, right? So just the end of this month.
Yeah,
on Thursday. That's a Thursday.
I'm going to be there.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go down and check it out. Maybe we can ride down there together, huh?
Excellent. And then just a sort of a heads up for May, the Rose City 500 is going to be happening down in Oregon. That's an annual ride.
Sure.
And I don't think they release the route details until you actually get there. So I don't know where they're going, but it's 500 miles, and it's a fundraiser for the Rose City Motorcycle Club.
And that sounds like that's going to be on the 7th, right? So that's down in Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, May 7th.
Okay. Sign in at 4:30 a.m.
All righty. Hey, let's just, let's take a break, and then we'll come back and do News Bites.
Sounds good.
Support for the SoundRider Show is provided in part by The Rally in the Gorge. Are you ready to go beyond the main roads? Since 2003, The Rally in the Gorge has introduced riders intimately to the awesome secondary and tertiary roads in the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. With programs for dual sport, adventure, sport touring, and sport bike enthusiasts, this is the rally you'll want to return to again and again. For more information, visit soundrider.com/rally.
This is Patrick Henry from Hinshaw's Motorcycle Store. You're listening to The Sound Rider Show.
Hi, this is Tracy Jeffries, and I'm one of the Dirty Girls, and one of the places that I love to go get dirty at is over in the Leavenworth Plain area.
All right, we are back at the Crow's Nest Studio here in beautiful downtown Broadview, Washington.
On a gorgeous day.
It's a gorgeous day. I don't know why we're in here recording this.
Yeah, I know. We should. Let's wrap this up and get on the bikes, huh?
So let's do a little bit of News Bites. We don't have a lot this month, but since it is spring and it's time to do some riding, we will have a little section on low elevation rides. But we'll start off with our first news bite, which just came in this morning that we found out that somebody is putting together a 24-hour WABDR ride.
Now, we're talking 575 miles.
575 miles.
Right.
Which, if you take that and divide it by 24 hours, you get an average speed of 24 miles an hour. So it's doable.
Sure. But we're talking about, too, in some of these sections, some pretty gnarly country, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cows, babyhead rocks.
Sure.
You know, and who knows what's going to wash out between now and then or where there's going to be a fire at that point.
It's going to be a lot of changes, definitely.
So it's going to be interesting to see how it goes down. I don't really have – I don't want to release people's names. There are people out there talking about this online. But,
sure.
You know, we don't know who's really going to do this when it comes right down to it. It's way too soon to say.
That's right. But it'll be interesting to keep an eye on. And, well, we talk about 24 hours, 575 miles. But how much sleep would you think you'd need? Six hours on
this? I don't think you're getting any sleep.
No sleep.
I think you're going to – you know, they do that 24 hours of Starvation Ridge. Remember that was going on when
right.
we did the show last year in Oregon?
That's right.
So this is like – I'm pretty sure this is a no-sleep deal, but, man, I don't know. You know, driving around at night
yeah.
with – it's not even a full moon.
Yeah, with no sleep at night. That's going to be interesting.
And, you know, they'll have – There's some supposedly maybe some sponsorship from Cyclops coming in, so they'll have like the brightest lights and all that. But
sure.
I don't want to be riding a motorcycle well, at hour number 22 up in, you know, if they're going south to north, they're going to be somewhere up outside.
Right.
Of, well, they'll be in the woods. Okay, they'll be up by Freeze Out Pass.
Sure.
And I don't know.
Well, this is almost like, this is definitely an endurance run. And you talk about hour 22, man, you're going to be seeing some visions out there in the woods.
I think at hour 22, some people will have already finished.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Hopefully.
But but you never know what's going to happen to
That's
the
true.
Bike out there. Or, and, you know, they've got to arrange to make sure they have fuel on the way.
Yep.
So, because you're not getting fuel at 3 a.m. somewhere.
Not in the middle of nowhere, Washington, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't think so anyway. So, well, you know, have to bring us some canisters along with you or maybe a support team. I don't know how you
yeah,
do
that.
Yeah,
maybe you need to get a Rotopax sponsorship.
There you go, yeah.
All right. Let's see. Pro Caliber Motorsports down in Vancouver has added Honda to the lineup. So that's a big deal for those guys. They've kind of been waiting for this for a long time. There used to be a Honda shop across the river in Gresham.
Sure.
And that went away during the recession.
And now you're stocking all four major Japanese OEMs.
Yeah, yeah.
Which
so
is, I mean,
Yamaha, Suzuki.
If you're in the area
Kia,
there and you
well,
want
no, to. That's not.
That's right.
Not Kia.
Well, that's not a major one anyway.
Kiyosaki.
That's right.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you know, that's going to be great if you're in the market for a new bike to be able to go down there and do some comparison shopping against all brands.
And so the last thing I want to talk about here is this Moto Shed that's coming up down on upper or lower Queen Anne Hill on the north side.
That's right, just here and just outside of downtown Seattle.
Yeah, so you're going to go down and do an interview with who? It was like a couple people? Because it's like a community, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But there's one guy who at least responded to the email, which we sent. We had a brief correspondence here. So I don't know a lot of details. I do know that on their Facebook page, they put up a picture of the shop, and it has just a few words on it, and it says mechanic, travel goods, custom seats, and event room. So very interested
okay.
to see exactly what's going to be going on here in Queen Anne.
It's a bit of a carcass down in the event room right now.
Yeah.
I have been into part of the building, the
okay.
lower part.
Sure.
And it's like a shared work area. And then I know there's people upstairs that have businesses that are all moto-related stuff that I could see.
That's great. You know, we always want to reach out to new riders. We always want to have places for existing riders to go to work on their bike, to get new products. And we're excited to have him here as part of the Seattle community.
And I know that there was a pretty big event in March that was done by a DOL task force down there. One thing I do know is the parking's really tight. So
yeah.
if you're going, take your motorcycle.
Bring
Don't
your motorcycle.
Expect to get parking around there in a car.
It's more and more the case here in Seattle, right?
Yeah. I don't know if they'll put a light rail station in next door or not, but
it's all just a matter of time before the entire city's light rail. I think that's their plan.
So that's kind of the news bites for this month. Yeah. And so let's take advantage of the time we have here, and let's talk a little bit about a few. I've got a list of some low elevation rides that people could do. They're paved rides. They're not dual sport rides.
Well, right on. Well, I haven't heard these yet, so I'm interested just as much as anybody else. Let's get into it.
Well, if you live in Washington, the Olympic Peninsula is always a nice place to go ride, as is the Kitsap Peninsula.
Right. Maybe a little underrated, don't you think, compared to the Olympic?
Yeah, exactly. People don't hear people talk about it that much, but there's some really nice roads over there. They all got names, not numbers.
And, right.
So that's if you live in Washington, that's going to be my recommendation for you. If you live in Oregon, travel south, and this is a great time of year to go ride the Kings Valley Road, which is a wonderful stretch of pavement that goes pretty far down from Portland. Not from Portland. You have to get there from Portland.
Right.
But you go like from out to McMinnville, and then you head south down the road. That's a really nice ride.
Kings Valley. That sounds like a good one.
Kings Valley. Nice thing about the Kings Valley Road is the way it's cut, it goes up and down over some ridges, and the road never goes more than 5%. You know why that was?
Why is that?
Because those are all old wagon roads, and they didn't want to make it any harder for the horses.
It makes sense, I guess,
so
yeah.
They maintained everything at 5%. So as a motorcyclist, that's awesome.
Yeah, so you're not looking at a lot of heavy braking and acceleration. You can kind of go out and enjoy life.
Yeah. Exactly. If you're in Idaho, I would recommend that you go up to somewhere along Highway 12, like Kamiai is a nice central spot, and get on SoundRider and read the article in the archive called The Lolo 7.
The Lolo 7.
So it's, in that article we're talking about not just Lolo Pass, but six other rides in that area that are probably all clear of snow right now. I don't know about Lolo Pass. I'm not sure if that's clear or not.
Coming up on that, I'm sure, though. Yeah. So if you're listening maybe towards the end of April.
But the Greer Grade, the Winchester Road, all that stuff, read about it online because I can't go into the details. It's it's like a 1,000-word article.
Yeah.
But some really fun roads to play on. And, everybody talks about how awesome Lolo Pass is
sure.
And all that. And it's totally overrated because it's totally over-patrolled.
Right.
But there are other roads that are around there are not that heavily patrolled. And frankly, they give you more twisties than you're getting on Lolo Pass.
Sure. Road. Well, a lot of times for things like that, for Lolo Pass, especially maybe for some of the dual sport riders out there, it's nice to have that target and then to go and explore the area around it.
Yeah.
Right?
But I don't think you'd want to get up on the old Lolo Road, which is the dirt road right now. That's probably snowed.
That's probably snowed in and probably looking at a pretty gnarly late springtime until it dries out a little in the summer.
Yep. All right. That's our News Bites and Low Elevation Rides segment. And let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll have our first interview.
Support for the Sound Riders Show is provided in part by Rich's Custom Seats. Do long days on the road take their toll on your body? That's because stock seats and generic aftermarket seats don't fit anybody. Have your motorcycle seat custom fit to your body. Improve your ergonomic positioning and enjoy long days in the saddle with a Rich's Custom Seat. Just a ferry ride from Seattle. Experience a Rich's Custom Seat today.
Hi guys, this is Bill from Revit. You're listening to the Sound Rider Show.
My name's Dana. I live in Seattle. I ride an R100 GS. I like to ride around the Cascades.
We are back with the Soundwriter Show. And we got a guest here today. Many people know him. He's famous. He owns a very popular motorcycle shop in Seattle.
One of the best.
Called Moto International. Welcome, Dave Richardson.
Famous for what?
Famous for all kinds of good things. Now, Moto International, specializing in Moto Guzzi and Aprilia motorcycles, right?
That is correct.
And do you guys carry any other lines down there?
No. Over the years, we've dabbled in a few, but that's the ones we stick to.
You're going to add Suzuki soon, aren't you?
That's been a rumor. I can't believe some of the rumors that we hear. I just love to have people tell me what they hear, because there's usually things that I hadn't even dreamed of.
That's right. Well, I think 3/4 of the motorcycling world is made up on rumors.
I'll bet you for April I could put a post up on Facebook for you to help you out.
Oh, I bet you could, yeah.
Well, the reason that we have you in here today, Dave, is to talk about motorcycle manufacturer warranties. But before we kind of roll into that, how is business down at Motor International? You guys have been there for a long time, right?
Well, we're in our 23rd year right now, 24th, I guess. Definitely, I think that we're seeing that the recession is over, and motorcycle shops kind of see what the world looks like now.
Right.
It certainly affected different shops different ways. I mean, the Japanese brands lost a lot of their customers. I think they have mostly younger customers, and the younger guys are less likely to have jobs with extra income, and if they do, they're kind of a new generation that isn't even interested in having a driver's license. So that's changed a bit. I mean, you look at just the nature of what's in Seattle now. I mean, there's no dealer for Suzuki or Yamaha within the city. And now we have 6 European brands within about a 2-mile triangle, you know.
Well, there definitely seems to be a draw to that. And I know I had read some statistics a little bit earlier. It seems like it's a record year for BMW, maybe KTM on that. A lot of these European brands are reporting record sales numbers here in the United States. Are you seeing that translate to Moto Guzzi?
Well, I don't know, because our dear company isn't one to give us numbers. But
sure.
I've certainly seen several of the European brands brag about record sales. I think we had our second biggest number of Guzzis purchased from us last year, and the largest number of Aprilia motorcycles. So definitely people like the brands, and they're responding to them.
Well, that definitely seems to be the case. And, of course, one of the big draws, I think, for many riders of buying a new motorcycle is the manufacturer's warranty, which is what we kind of want to get into detail down here, because it's something not too many people, I think, know a lot about. And for instance, just as starters here, there are more than one type of manufacturer warranties, right? What can you tell us a little bit about the different types that there are?
Well, it is an interesting subject, because people assume that warranty means that things are covered end-to-end and for as long as the warranty lasts, and maybe longer than that. And some people think that it includes regular maintenance and things like that.
Sure.
As far as I know, and anything other than a Mercedes or something like that, that's not true. But yeah, thinking about it, I thought, well, there's certainly the manufacturer's warranty that comes with the bike, and it's essentially something you're buying with the bike. You're buying a motorcycle, you're buying a warranty. And the warranty is between the retail purchaser and the manufacturer or distributor. It has really nothing to do with the dealer, other than the dealer is the person or company that carries it out on each of their behalfs.
Sure.
And I've often said that, you know, as the dealer, I kind of feel like the waiter in a restaurant. You know, I'm sort of working for both sides, and I can't really favor either one. I'm trying to make everybody happy at the same
diplomat,
time.
The diplomat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we carry out a warranty on behalf of the manufacturer. Now, when a person comes in and says, hey, I got this little problem on my bike, okay. Just because you have a warranty and it says it's covered doesn't mean that it is guaranteed to be covered. The dealer has to apply for the warranty to the manufacturer and get an approval.
Sure.
So there is a little bit of a process there. I mean, you could essentially bring a bike in for a warranty service and find that for some reason the manufacturer is going to say, this is not covered, and then you've already brought your bike in, the shop has done the service well, then the customer might actually be obligated to pay. So, you know, something to know. And not all warranties are the same. There's different lengths of time. I know there's different companies have 1-year, 2-year, 3-year warranties. Some have a mileage limit. Some of them are open-ended, that it's as many miles as you can put on the bike in the time you have it. Then there's some manufacturers, it covers everything on the bike. Others will say specific exclusions. I think that in the research I did for this, I found that there are companies that make big sport bikes that do not cover them for track use or racing, and there's other companies that do. So there's a variety there. There are manufacturers that have little quiet limits where they say, well, like the upholstery on the seat is covered on this thing for 6 months or a year. After that, we consider that if you have a stitching come apart, that's a wear item and it's not covered.
Right.
Or maybe we're going to cover your brake disc for warping for the first 5 or 10,000 miles, but after that we consider it to be a wear item and it's no longer covered by warranty. So there's a whole lot more to it than just, oh, it's covered for 2 years, 3 years, or something like that.
Well, so when I buy a bike and they say there's a two-year warranty on a bike, if I read that closely, I start seeing the nickel and a diming going on?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay. And it really varies a lot. I mean, we were a dealer for Hyosung a few years ago, and, you know, Korean company trying to make a mark in the U.S. and probably being a little naive, and they just said, oh, of course, our warranty covers everything end-to-end for the full 2 years. And I don't know how many manufacturers do that. Maybe more do than I know, but I would think that over time they come up with more and more exclusions.
Well, and that kind of makes sense when you think about it, right? Because compared to maybe an automobile where you're going to be looking at the bell curve of usage is going to be much more concentrated, whereas a motorcycle, people have a lot of different usage patterns, right? I mean, you get people who ride motorcycles pretty hard. Some people store them outdoors. Some people have them in garages. It kind of makes sense, I guess, from a manufacturer's standpoint to have more details as far as what will and what will not void the warranty.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, that's why the legislature goes into session every year, because they keep finding more little things that need to be covered. And I think, you know, it's one of the reasons why a lot of motorcycle warranties are open-ended as far as mileage, because they realize that most people really don't ride them that much.
Sure. Now, so I think that a good takeaway from this would be that when you purchase a new bike and it says it's under warranty, before they go and they throw you the keys, to maybe say, sit down and kind of look at the warranty and try to figure out exactly what is included in that warranty.
Yeah, well, you will always get a printed manual with the bike, and it'll give some details of warranty. And then it's probably good to also say, are there other things that I need to know about the warranty? There could be things that are not even listed in the booklet.
Sure.
Which to me strikes me as being probably not something that could be enforced in a court of law if it's not written down.
But, right.
Yeah, I think there are things to be known like that.
Well, and it's nice, I think, to have a little preparation in, because you talk about the court of law. Who wants to go to small claims court, right, and take all that time for a few $100 repair? It'd be nice to know what you're getting into ahead of time.
Well, exactly. I mean, I just heard one on Car Talk last week on NPR, and someone was calling in, you know, a major brand of automobile and saying, well, I had this warranty repair, I thought, but then the manufacturer turned it down. So
sure.
this happens in all realms, actually.
Yeah, and I can understand that. And what is your kind of feeling, I guess, in general about maybe like extended warranties and that kind of thing? Do you feel like warranties over the long term are a worthwhile investment?
Well, it depends on the kind of person you are.
Yeah.
I mean, to some people, you know, that you can get not only an extended warranty on your bike, you can get a separate tire warranty, just so that you know that if I have a flat on the road, I can just call up a number and someone's going to come and take care of me. So it just depends on what's important to you. Certainly, an extended warranty means that you'll have a warranty that extends after you have expired the new bike warranty. And that might be something that a dealership offers that comes from the manufacturer of the bike, and it could be from a third party, in which case it's basically just an insurance policy.
Sure.
And then similarly, a dealership might offer a warranty on a used bike that is also something that they purchase from a third party.
What are some of the things, because I know a lot of people, you know, they'll buy a new bike, and then there's all kinds of adjustments and retrofits and maybe upgrades that they want to do. What are some common things that you see that void warranties?
Well, you know, if you read what most manufacturers say, it's like if you put on any accessory that is not a factory-approved accessory, then they can void your warranty. And it's like, well, I've never heard of anyone sitting, you know, facing a situation they put on a luggage rack and
right.
and they voided their engine warranty. But, you know, I've heard it from the manufacturer's standpoint, and there are some things that make sense. They develop a motorcycle, and they test it, and they know that this bike is going to perform really great, and it's going to do everything you expect for as long as you expect in the form that they make it. Now, is it fair to the manufacturer that Joe Schmo is going to buy the bike and put on some other exhaust and some other camshaft and all these things and then say, gee, I, you know, ran the bike and it blew up? Well, the manufacturer didn't test it that way, and we don't know how it was put together and all that. So I can see their point on some of this stuff.
Of course.
Then some of the stuff comes up that has to do with the homologation of the bike, what it is passed by EPA to be legal running. I mean, some people don't even realize that anytime you change the exhaust system on a bike, you have made it probably illegal to the EPA. I mean, it's not legal to put loud mufflers on your bike.
Right.
But the manufacturers will say, well, we will sell you an exhaust, and then that will, if you buy our exhaust and have it tuned the way we say to do it, then you're still covered by warranty. But if you do something aftermarket, or if you do some tuning other than what we authorize, then you're not. I heard of one manufacturer, and I'm not going to name names here, I'm not going to try to point fingers at anyone,
sure,
but a major manufacturer that you bring your bike in for service, and the dealership hooks your bike up to their diagnostic system, and the company can know if the computer fuel injection mapping has been altered to something other than what they've approved, and they can void your warranty right on the spot.
Without your consent, essentially. So you
exactly.
go in for a tune-up at the beginning of spring, and they go, oh, by the way,
yeah,
we've just voided your warranty because you made a few adjustments to mm-hmm. Whatever it may be. How are these warranty laws, do they tend to, I mean, we're talking a little bit removed from federal, right? Is this more from state to state where a lot of these battles are fought?
Not as far as I know. The state has very little to do with it. All I know that the state has to do with the warranty is through the Department of Licensing. They want to know that if somebody is selling a new vehicle, car, bike, motorcycle, scooter, whatever, that if it has a warranty, that there is a dealership that has a service facility somewhere.
Sure.
Now, I've heard of some pretty sketchy ones, like one of the big warehouse stores was selling, I can't remember, some motor or scooter a few years ago, and the only service outlet in the whole state was some little shop that wasn't even selling new vehicles in some small town in the middle of nowhere.
Well, we saw, I think, Costco this year, right, was going to try out Husqvarna's?
Yep.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So you see some really...
But see, they had the serviceability down there in Bend, Oregon where
sure.
they were doing that at.
Right, know. So somewhere in the neighborhood. But
the only thing else I've ever heard was that the Department of Licensing also keeps track of each franchise dealership as to what brands they represent, so that let's say that someone decided that they don't like dealing with Moto International and they have an Aprilia with a warranty problem, they could essentially go to the State Department of Licensing and say who else is a franchise dealer and find out that Ride Motorsports in Woodinville could do that
sure.
job. And I'm thinking, well, how many people probably ever make that kind of a request to the state in a year? Yeah.
Right. That's definitely one thing to take into consideration. But let's talk about, and this is kind of maybe a little bit of a corollary to warranties, but how about lemon laws? Are there such a thing for motorcycles as there are for cars? If something goes completely wrong, you've got a fairly new motorcycle. What are the state lemon laws like, particularly here in Washington, where you might be a little more familiar?
Well, lemon law does apply to most larger motorcycles. There's a displacement cutoff, and I don't even know what it is because it's smaller than what we sell.
Sure.
And the lemon law will say that if the bike or the vehicle was not repaired in so many times of trying or in so many total days of being in the shop, then it is possible to take it to apply the lemon law so that it's taken to some kind of an arbitration. I tend to find that those things are not very favorable to the customer, that the percentage that they will get will be a lot less than they think. It's not like, you know, I just bought my bike a year and a half ago and I expect to get the full price back. You know, it's not going to be like that. I find that if someone's got a problem that, you know, talking with the dealer, talking to the manufacturer, you know, and if they feel like they want to get a bike replaced, you'll really make your case to them. I think you're more likely to get a fair settlement. And that's an interesting thing, too, because when someone says to me, gee, you had to replace the piston on my bike, I feel like my bike is not new and original anymore. I feel like it's been devalued.
Interesting.
You know, I want to have my bike replaced. And they say, well, your warranty says that you bought a bike and you got a warranty, and it says if there's a problem, we fix it. It doesn't say that, you know, because you consider it non-virginal now that you get a replacement. You know, and I've said to people, okay, you feel like your bike has a new piston in it, it's not original, you couldn't ever sell it for the same value again used. What if we replaced an oil pressure sender on the engine? Would you feel the same way? Well, no.
Sure.
Okay, well, then where is the line
right.
for that?
You know? Oftentimes people are going to try to get the most that they can for
sure.
anything. Sure.
But it's not even just people trying to get the most. It's just their feeling that their bike has sort of been violated. And there's some point at which the repair is deep enough that that is their feeling. There's a major manufacturer right now that has a transmission problem with a big sport bike, and their solution is to replace the transmission or some portion of it.
So that brings us to recalls then, right?
That would be a recall, sure. Right? And in that case, you know, the customer can say, well, man, I'd go for you replacing the engine, but, you know, to have a guy taking the engine apart and
really
doing all that
around with the whole thing, right?
Right. But, you know, dealerships spend a lot of money to train their mechanics and hire trained people and train people who go to school to learn to do the work.
Ideally, anyway, yeah.
Get sent to service schools and things like that. So we would consider the guy doing that work to be competent.
So, you know, I'm never happy when I buy a motorcycle until it's yellow.
Oh, we know that.
So if I buy the new motorcycle and take it to the painter and he tears it all down, paints it, and puts it back together again, I always wonder, where is that going to leave my warranty?
I don't know, but to me, I would think that's ridiculous that anyone would ever question that. And there's a lot of things that I would say if other shops are like ours, it's best that the manufacturers don't know. We're not going to say, hey, by the way, this guy's painted his bike yellow.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of body work that comes off, a lot of wiring that gets undone and put back together again. And you know, it always makes me wonder if it's enough to trigger a cancellation of the warranty.
Well, I think it'd be a hard case to make. And there again, a manufacturer can turn down a claim or say that a warranty is void for some reason. And I don't know exactly where the customer goes with that. I don't know that there's any place to arbitrate that other than just taking them to small claims court if you had a claim and it was turned down. And that's kind of a questionable thing, too. I wish that there was something that was more of an available arbitration for people.
So I want to get just a few tips to wrap up here on sort of how to maximize maybe that manufacturer's warranty. But it sounds to me like one thing to keep in mind is, again, another emphasis on shopping local and building that relationship with your local dealer, because a lot of this can be, in a sense, a sort of a casual arbitration where maybe you do paint it, right? And then you take it down to, say, to you down at Moto Guzzi or at Moto International. And it might be one of those things where you say, okay, this is reasonable. He just had it painted. This has nothing to do with voiding the warranty. And then maybe you can work with the manufacturer to kind of get an adequate amount of justice if something were to go wrong. Do you think that that's a good suggestion to kind of build that relationship with your dealer?
Well, I don't think that, you know, anything is ever going to come of a painting situation. But sure. I think in general, definitely the more communication that goes on when somebody has a warranty problem, the more likely everyone's going to be happy with the result. And one thing about that is to remember that, as I said, warranty is between the person that buys the bike and the manufacturer. And that, you know, to say to your dealer, I'm not happy with this, I want my bike bought back. Well, that's kind of really the person's problem to go talk to the manufacturer. But, you know, to be talking during the process if something is going to take a little longer, if something doesn't get fixed in the first try or something like that. You know, we're getting to the point now where mechanical stuff is so perfected, but electronics are getting wilder and wilder. So there's more
that's
of a chance that with the electronics that, you know, it's not always going to be figured out the first time. Again, I like the Car Talk boys because they give me the confidence of realizing that even on their level, sometimes you have to throw a couple things at the problem before you find out what the solution is.
Well, I think those are some excellent points there. And again, Dave, I want to thank you for taking the time to stop by today on the Sound Rider Show. Really some great information on warranties. And I also want to thank you for helping me out last month in March and lending me the V7 Stone 2 to take for a test ride. Where can our listeners find out a little bit more about Moto International? You have a web address, I know, and if you could just let our listeners in on that.
Well, thanks, Terry.
Yeah,
MotoInternational.com, M-O-T-O International, and we're at 7701 Aurora Avenue North. The phone number is 206-297-3822.
Dave Richardson from Moto International in Seattle, thanks again for being on the Sound Rider Show.
Hey, Dave, I just want to say, you know, we've been at this for 17 years, and you've been a longtime supporter, and we appreciate it. It's people like you that make it possible for us to do this show, that make it possible for us to have the magazine. We appreciate the support.
A huge thanks, definitely.
Well, we appreciate you guys, because the most important thing with motorcycling is having some outlets to use the bikes, and you guys give a lot of possibilities to people.
Well, we appreciate it again, Dave. Again, Moto International, Dave Richardson, thanks so much for being on the Sound Rider Show.
Support for the Sound Rider Show is provided in part by Moon Motorcycles, a family-run operation located in Issaquah, Washington. Moon Motorcycles features a diverse selection of used bikes to choose from. Whether you're shopping for a used sport bike, cruiser, dual sport, sport touring, or street standard, you owe it to yourself to visit Moon Motorcycles and look over their large inventory. Have you got a used bike you want to consign? Get in touch with Moon Motorcycles today.
Hey, this is Benny with Langlands Leathers, and you're listening to the Sound Rider Show.
Hi, my name is Steve. I'm from Olympia, Washington. My favorite area to ride in is around Kamei, Idaho, where the gravel roads are fantastic and the paved roads are even better.
Welcome back to the Sound Rider Show. And riders, while we were out at the break, I just happened to run into this guy in Seattle. He doesn't live here. I would have had to go down to Oregon to interview him, but he's here, and so I hauled him in. And I'm sitting here now with Rob Birch from the MotoFit Group out of the Portland area. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Happy to be here.
So you have a group that puts on track days. You've been doing that now for 4 years?
Since 2009.
Oh, 2009. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's like 6-7 years. Can't really do much math very well, but... it seems to me like having a track day company is kind of like opening up a restaurant. It's crazy, man. How'd you get into it?
Well, I think my passion for helping people just drove me to want to make a fundamental difference for motorcyclists. I felt like from the time I've been a little kid, I've always looked at carving sports with a lot of interest more than, you know, team sports so much. But, all individual sports, the methodology is... having a technique to do it right. And I feel like my entire life has kind of led me down this path to understanding how to do things better. And for some reason, the motorcycle became the palette by which I, you know, love to paint with. And it's incredibly rewarding. I think that's probably the most anybody that can say about anybody out there helping people ride motorcycles better is the payback is really seeing that person understand something more about the experience. So that would be it. I think that helping people is critical to sustaining the viability of this sport. With so many people crashing on the street,
yeah,
something needed to change.
Okay, so... a lot of our riders have not taken a track day before. So what is the benefit to a rider to go and take a track day now and then?
Well, frankly, taking people out to a racetrack to help them understand the process of riding a motorcycle better is, let me back that up. We can't learn the same way riding around on the street that we can on a racetrack.
Okay.
You know, when you're in a controlled environment, you're able to really observe riders in their purest form without the distractions of traffic, side streets, cars, animals, you know, the unknown, the great unknown. But you can essentially watch a motorcyclist ride up to the first corner and see how they're thinking about, you know, processing that corner. And everybody, for the most part, does everything at the last second.
So they really get to, on the track, they really just get to focus all those memory processes in one direction and not be worrying about the defensive techniques of riding in the street.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct. So essentially, we're working on building people's situational awareness. And that's probably the biggest takeaway that anybody can expect to have from a track day, riding around in a controlled environment with people that are helping you be more aware of what you need to do before you get to a corner. So we basically help people understand how to plan better. And because they're planning better, it helps them stay calmer because they know what's going to happen next, because they're more at cause. Hence, their situational awareness goes up because, you know, as we know, it's very difficult to be clear when you're afraid of something. If you're nervous or you're distracted by anything, it's difficult to, you know, fill your mind with what you should be focusing on and be more at cause.
This gotcha.
Yeah.
Now, what is your goal or what should the student expect to take away with after having done a 1 or 2 day event with you?
Well, I think they'll never be the same rider again. I think that's the first thing that they can expect. And that might sound like a real mouthful, but you know, in the end, it's understanding how to ride your bike more effectively by doing less, by focusing on a few very basic fundamentals of riding that we already possess the ability to master. It's not anything beyond anybody's realm of consciousness or, you know, a far-off goal. It's a very simple approach to understanding how to be more effective as a motorcycle rider.
But yeah, we need to get the dots out in front of us, and then you have to help us connect those dots.
Correct.
Gotcha. Can you give us an idea of what a typical day is like for a student out at the track?
Sure. Well, if you're out there for the first time, you'll register at about 7 o'clock. Registration opens at about 7:15, so you get to meet my smiling wife and, you know, get ribbed a little bit because she's a real character. So that's your first taste of the morning. She'll then give you a schedule and your paperwork to go pick your bike up or go take your bike on down to tech inspection and have your bike looked at. So we have some real basic guidelines. You know, you need to have at least 50% wear on your tires. Your brake pads have to be at least 50%. It's best when your motorcycle is clean and well maintained because it basically tells us in tech that you care about this machine. So you know, a little more fastidious to the details, which is, you know, the other side of riding a motorcycle is becoming more familiar with the mechanics of it. And I think, you know, our process is very thorough. I mean, we take a really good look at your bike to make sure it's absolutely safe before it gets out onto the track.
Do you have like a standard, like a 21-point inspection
that
you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can actually find that on our website as well. So that can be a little more detailed explanation as to what we look at. But, you know, clean is a good way to show up. So after that, we have our riders meeting at 8:15, and we basically go over what the day is going to look like as far as when the different groups are running, safety protocols, passing protocols. Essentially, you know, we set the stage for helping everybody to perform at their best. So you're not going out there blindly just trying to go fast. It's like, you really understand, you know, why you're there and what the objective is, which for all of us is to be a better rider at the end of the day.
And there's three different groups that you run during the day. So they're all going out at different times. So a new rider is going to be in a newbie group.
Correct. Well, we prefer to call it the riders group because okay. We look at all motorcyclists as coming to us with some level of experience, even though, you know, you might not be a real proficient rider. Maybe you're a brand new rider. Maybe you're a returning rider or a rider that's even got your endorsement, but are still, you know, not sure how to manage the motorcycle.
And what's the other two groups?
The blue group is more for returning faster street riders, people that have really, you know, got the Jones and they need to feed the monkey. So they're evolving riders. And then the Black Group is a very advanced riding environment where you have guys like myself who used to be racers and we're just out there because we love motorsports and we need a place to play with each other in.
So does each group have instructors within it?
There are instructors in each group. And the real differences between the three groups would have to be the passing rules and obviously the speed. However, the green group, although, you know, fortified with more instructors, it's different than just the speed because combined with the green group program, you get 7 on-track sessions. Everybody gets 7 on-track sessions. Mm-hmm. But we give you 5 classroom sessions where we have a formula to, you know, help people become acclimated to the situation.
Yeah, so there's a curriculum for that. Is there a curriculum on the blue and the black group, or is it more like, this is what do you guys need to focus on today, and then let's create the curriculum now?
Correct. Okay. So we can, you know, narrow it down more in the other groups to specifics of what somebody's needs are. But the, you know, the green group, I look at it like, we have a bunch of new people coming out to the track all the time in the green group. There are people that just enjoy riding in the green group. But if you're a new rider and you come out to the track, we understand that you probably haven't slept the night before or that your social network has melted down because your friends are going, you hardly know how to ride a motorcycle. You're crazy. You're going to a racetrack to learn how to ride a bike. Why would you do that? So we understand all this and the fact that, you know, you might be showing up and there's, you know, some fear there or a little more anxiety than normal. And here we are, you know, a group of guys saying, okay, now we're going to help you by telling you something about riding a motorcycle. Let me tell you something.
So it might be braking, might be cornering, might be line selection, might be apex position.
Well, it's very simple, actually. We do it in modules. So our first module, we call it the R module, to help people understand how to relax on their bike. Then we give them a planning tool, which I developed years ago, body brakes, gear, gas, so they know something to do before they get to the corner. And then simply we talk about understanding what proper body positioning is and how being a good passenger on your motorcycle is critical to really being at charge and in control.
Okay, so when I go and take a class, one of the things that's hard for me is I can't retain everything. Are there some takeaways that I get when I finish a track day?
Absolutely. Simply, we don't overload you. Like, you know, it's so easy to, I'm rather long-winded, but it's so easy to overload people. But what we basically give people is a beginning, a point to begin. And once we can lay this foundation, we can then start, you know, dialing people in on more specific needs. But we basically have part one and part two in our green group. Part one is on Saturday, part two is on Sunday. And by the end of that experience, people have a really good understanding of what they should be thinking about when they're riding a motorcycle.
So when I say takeaways, I'm talking about like some documents that I can take with me?
Absolutely. Okay. Everybody gets to take home their syllabus. And
got it.
That's really used on day one. But day two, we introduce a notebook where we help people understand how to focus on a specific task, be it, you know, riding across town to get milk and having a pre-ride ritual so you're a little more tuned in to that experience rather than just going out, hopping on your bike, and riding to the store.
And this notebook is meant to be somewhat of a diary after you leave the class, right? Where you just put entries in there now and then about where you're at and where you want to go, and then you look back at it 3 months later and say, hey, I did it.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool.
Or, you know, more significantly is the way we like lay this out, it basically gives you one thing to think about, one thing to really focus on when you're working on the track. And people can, you know, translate that to all different things when they're taking a trip somewhere or, like I said, just going to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is to have a focus. Okay, and the notebook gives you an opportunity to come back and report to yourself how well you did with what you were focusing on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, and then, of course, also the instructors are out there commenting back and forth with the students and giving them feedback on where they need to focus and that sort of thing. Now, another question I have is, like, what are the gear requirements? Can I just show up in my blue jeans and tennis shoes and go ride, or what do I got to wear?
Yeah, well, not so much the jeans, but you're more than welcome to come out and ride in the green group in textile riding gear. Actually, for that group, you don't even need to have a jacket that zips to your pants. We do require that you have boots on that cover your ankle. Also, we prefer that people wear gauntlet-style gloves to cover the wrist. And we are really advocates of body armor, such as an additional back protector. Mm-hmm. And ideally, I'd like to see people wearing a chest protector. But we really would like to see you out there in a back protector that's separate from your jacket. But initially, for riding in the green group, we'll let you by with a jacket that has good armor in it.
Okay, and then what about my bike? Do I have to race wire it? Do I have to tape it up? What would I need to do?
Yeah, not so much. Depending on what the light is made out of, if it's plastic, we'll tape it. If it's polycarbonate, we'll just unplug it or show you how to pull your fuse out so your lights aren't on. You're welcome to show up with your mirrors on or take them off or tape them. We also don't require that anything is safety wired, and it's perfectly fine to have antifreeze in your bike. But in tech inspection, it's, you know, where we are really critically looking at your bike to make sure that you don't have any leaking fluids anywhere and that your bike is in good, clean operating condition.
And I think sometimes when people think of a track day, they think of it as like, well, that's what the guys with the sport bikes do. But I could come on a cruiser, or I could come on a maxi scooter.
I don't know about the scooter, but certainly any cruiser or motorcycle from what I call the big bike category.
Uh-huh.
So we've had plenty of guys out there on Valkyries and Harleys. And
how about dual sport guys?
Dual sports, absolutely. I mean, we see plenty of GSs out there and KTM adventurers.
You know, I think you don't want me to come with my scooter because you know I'll just smoke everybody.
Well, that could be it, Tom.
All right. So this year, 2016, you guys are doing four sessions, and it's 2 days each, but you can sign up for 1 day or 2 day within those. So you're at Oregon Raceway Park twice this year.
Right.
And twice out at the Ridge.
And
the schedule's online. And your website is, don't go to motofit.com. You want to go to motofitgroup.com. And if you forget that, just Google MotoFit. And it'll probably come up first in your search engine because it's closest to you if you're here in the Pacific Northwest. So really good having you out here today.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
And I look forward to doing more stuff with you guys, and we're going to try to have Rob on the schedule at the Rally in the Gorge as well.
Look forward to that as well. Thanks for including us, Tom.
All right. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Support for the Sound Riders Show is provided in part by South Sound Honda, serving the South Puget Sound region for more than 5 decades. South Sound Honda, located in Olympia, is your destination for fun.
Hello, this is Bob Owen from the Sound Rider crew. The Northwest is indeed a great place to ride a motorcycle, both on the pavement and off. But right now, you're listening to the Sound Rider Show.
I'm Roy Barnes. I ride a BMW F650 GS 2009 with 130-some-thousand miles on it. My favorite ride is wherever the road goes.
Back on the Sound Rider Show with our final interview, and one that I am very excited for. I'd say maybe in all of our episodes, this is the one that I think is going to be most interesting to listeners. We're here with Liam Stewart, who claims that his great-grandfather is responsible for inventing the electric motorcycle.
Yeah, that's very true.
Well,
very true.
Welcome to the show here, Liam.
Thank you.
Liam.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you contacted me on Instagram and asked to be on the show because you wanted to defend your right to the title of who invented the electric motorcycle.
Yeah, they got it all wrong. People are off on a hike.
So, yeah, so I looked it up on Wikipedia, and apparently the guy that they say invented it, that's not the guy.
No, it was my great-grandfather.
Okay, and then they say that it was invented in England, but you say that it actually has Pacific Northwest roots.
Very, very true. There's a lot of hydroelectric up here.
Oh, so he just could, like, plug this thing into a dam and go?
Well, he had to play with the method of electronics and electricity. He found himself a good battery and then tried to do it with solar power to begin with, but then had to eventually resort to plugging it in, charging it up.
Yeah, because I don't think the solar power would be too good up here in the Pacific Northwest.
A little tough, huh? Definitely.
So well, that's interesting, and... Derek, you had a couple of questions, or?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out. So they always say like the originations of the electric motorcycle over in Europe or maybe on the East Coast. But I mean, were you aware of this all through your youth, or did this just was this something that you discovered kind of going through family archives as an adult?
Well, I'd always heard that my great grandfather was a very clever man, and that I should be very proud of my lineage because of it. But
And you are pretty proud of your lineage, aren't you?
Oh, I've got a long lineage. And I've read a little more about great-grandpa and his many inventions.
And so you don't think it's possible that he could have had two names and been in two places at the same time?
I don't really think so. My great-grandmother sometimes questioned it.
Right.
All right. Now, you also told me off the mic that it was your grandfather who invented the snowmobile.
Well, that's very, very true, too. He came from the Minnesota region, and he had one of great-grandpa's motorcycles, but during the winter, he had a heck of a hard time riding it, and so he tried to make it a four-wheeler, and that didn't work out so well, so he put tractor treads on it.
Wow.
That's impressive stuff, and it sounds like maybe, was this an electric one as well, the snowmobile, or were we talking about gas-powered at this stage?
Well, that started off as the electric because he had one of the motorcycles, but again, because of the amount of use and the area he was in, he had to add a little power to it. So I think he came up with the first...
sort of hybrid?
Hybrid
sure.
Vehicle.
Ah. Did he add solar to that later?
He was thinking about it, but because he was up there in that northern climate, the solar panel didn't work too well.
Hmm. Wow. All right. Considering that your great-grandfather supposedly invented the electric motorcycle.
No, he did. Don't do this supposed business.
Okay. And then your grandfather invented the snowmobile.
That's correct.
So I'd like to know, you know, it sounds like a lot of inventors in the family. What sort of things have you invented?
Well, I invented this whole story, to tell you the truth.
Well, all right. We'll be right back with the closing segment of the show.
Jump left. Jump right. Jump left. Jump right.
And just running out of gas here on this April episode of the Sound Rider Show. And of course, we always like to leave listeners with a tip of the month. And I know, as always, we've got some good ones this month. And I'm just going to go ahead and lead off on this one, Tom, and tell the listeners and you what my tip of the month is. And heading in here to touring season, my tip of the month is to evaluate your tools. I think this is a good month to do that.
Good point.
Yep. Get everything spread out. Check, see what you've got, what you used last year, what needs to be replaced. A lot of things, you know, like lubricants or small items might have disappeared. Lubricants might expire. And, you know, just to make sure that you're all set so you don't have any hiccups here in the summer months, the warmer months, when you head out on those week-long journeys.
So that would include your tire repair kit as well?
It would, absolutely. And if you don't have a tire repair kit...
I know where to get one.
Where would that be?
Store.soundrider.com.
That's right, for the best tire repair kit in the industry.
Yeah, so in the tire repair kit, you're checking to make sure you've got an ample amount of patches and inserts.
Sure.
But more importantly, you want to need to check your glue. Because if you used your glue at all last year,
right,
it could have stiffened up over the winter.
Yep.
So you got to replace that. We've got it in nice big 20 millimeter tubes, milliliter tubes on the store. And we've got all the patches. We've got the whole kit if you need a whole kit. So people say, like, what tools should I take with me?
Yeah.
And my recommendation always is whatever you need to do a level one and a level two service on your bike.
I think that's a good recommendation.
And if you're not sure what that is, look it up in your manual. Pull your manual out and go through and find every tool you need to do that. Because a lot of bikes don't come with a toolkit now, so you got to make your own up.
That's true, and you're probably better off anyway, because in the past, those factory toolkits didn't really offer
that's
too
true.
Much. Yeah.
Sandcast, cheap junk.
Right.
Breakable.
But the last thing you want is to be...
Unless it was a Honda toolkit.
Company man. The last thing that you want, though, is to be on hour 22 of the 24-hour WABDR and have your glue stiffened up in your tire repair kit.
Yeah.
Right? So you got to make sure that you've got that...
Or find out the nozzle broke off of your slime tube or something.
Yes, that's right. So break it all out, spread it out on the living room or the garage floor, evaluate it, and put it back together nice and tight so it'll pack in with the rest of your gear.
All right. Well, I got a tip, and it's more of something to think about. And people should think about this because the day is going to come, even when they're on a tour, that they're going to be sick.
Sure.
They're either going to have the flu or they're going to get food poisoning.
Yep.
And you need to kind of play it through your head ahead of time. What would you do if you get sick?
Right.
Now, how about you? You've been down to Central America on the
That's
motorcycle.
Right.
What did you ever get sick at all during the trip?
You know, I was fortunate enough to stay healthy the entire time, but that is definitely something that you do think about, because there can be long stretches between places like hotels. You may not have the cash, which would be another thing to take into consideration there. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the preparation tips that you might have.
Well, if you get food poisoning, I'm going to tell you right now, you go find a store that has some Pedialyte,
yeah,
and you lock yourself up in a hotel room until you feel better again.
Stay hydrated.
Don't try to ride a motorcycle when you have food poisoning. It doesn't work well.
And you talk about dehydration factor when you're out on a bike and blazing hot sun, that wind just sucking the moisture out of you, the heat just baking you. You will not, that'll not end well for anybody.
And when we were on the road trip tour last summer down in California, I got the flu.
Yeah.
So I did ride Sunday, Monday, Tuesday with the flu. Didn't really enjoy it, but I did it.
Sure.
And then Wednesday, I took the day off.
Yeah.
And that really paid off.
A recovery
day.
Because
then I got up Thursday and I was ready to go again.
Right.
But your body's going to tell you when it's time to get off the bike, and you just need to listen to it, and you'll have to change your plans.
That's right.
So
maintain some flexibility, bring some extra TP just in case, and maybe some general medications, aspirin, and that kind of thing can always be handy too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up our show. I hope we're going to see you guys and ladies out in Issaquah on the 31st for the Glider Cycle World Tour. It's going to be a lot of fun again.
I'm looking forward to that.
And regardless of what you do, don't ride like my mother.
And don't ride like my mother. We will see you next month in May.
The Sound Rider Show was made possible by today's sponsors and the patience of everyone else involved, which is not to say we're doctors. Reproduction of this program in part or in whole is not legal without the express written consent of the podcast owner. But please be sure to share the link with all your Facebook friends. This program is a production of Mixed Media. The content and views of today's guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of any major media conglomerate anywhere else in the world, including CBS, NBC, ABC, MotoGP, the BBC, PBS, NPR, the Discovery Network, or the Cartoon Channel. See you next time on The Sound Rider Show.